This is Car Expert.
I didn't think this was going to be much more than just a hotted up Yaris. This thing is like next level.
This ute looks to be their most serious effort yet.
I think this could be really the shot in the arm that Ford really needs, but it's not Ranger or Mustang.
Why, hello there. My name is Mandy Turner, and this week I am joined by William Stopford.
Hey, Mandy.
And James Wong, hello.
Hey, guys, how are you?
Very good, thank you. I got to say, I think, Will, you're a little bit flustered, though. You're about 10 minutes late for the podcast this week, but you have a very good reason. Why is that?
Oh, it's very, very, very important. I had to pick up a die-cast model. To be fair, I had other errands to do on my lunch break.
Sure.
And I have yet to eat lunch. But something, I came across something on Gumtree last night, and I had to get it because I had not seen any of these online before. I've seen 118 scale models of Ford BA Falcon XR8s before, but not in Phantom Purple. I may not have owned an XR8, but I owned an almost visually identical XR6 in the exact same color. And that was actually the first car I ever bought with my own money. So for me to actually see like my car in 118 scale form on my desk, I could not pass up that opportunity. I really do miss that car.
Nerd.
I think it would be normal for a car journalist to have model cars sitting on their desk. So I don't see anything wrong with this.
I've literally got a McLaren F1 Hot Wheels car still in its packaging sitting on my desk right next to me. So I understand the appeal.
On my desk here at the moment, because I was moving house, I thought, well, I'll just keep all of mine somewhere safe so they don't get damaged in the move. So I've actually got them all laid out on my desk here up at the Brisbane office.
At our old work, I can't remember how many bloody cars I had to pack up when I left. The boxes and boxes and boxes of cars that I had to bring home. I think the boxes are still somewhere in my room.
And Will's extra happy now he has a miniature version of his old car.
No.
What brand is the model?
It is called Biante. I think that they do a lot of Australian cars. It's actually really funny because when I was looking online, I thought, I wouldn't mind maybe getting like a scale VF Commodore or something like that. Nope, they're super expensive. Granted, I paid a little bit more for this one than ones in different colors, but I didn't want one in red or acid yellow or anything like that. But this will actually be my first scale model of an Australian car, so it'll join a bunch of American cars on my desk here.
Biante, is that Italian?
I don't know if I pronounced that correctly.
It sounds like an Italian word, but definitely I don't know where they're made, actually.
It was crafted in China.
I'm just Googling it now.
Last crawl for the correct pronunciation because he tends to be good with that. Lamborghini.
And you need that. You need that with a very extensive hand movement.
Oh my God. Even when he's not here, he's here.
Oh wow, yeah. I just looked them up online and they have some very expensive models.
Yeah. You know what though? They're Australian.
Yeah.
I found some overseas ones. Like I found an Aston Martin Vantage GT3 Bathurst car and it's $290.
Yeah. Whoa.
Jesus.
An Australian owned designer, producer and distributor in Perth.
That's so cool.
That is
really cool, but obviously made in China.
There's actually a really cool shop at Westfield Doncaster in Melbourne that is very close to my house, and they have like a game store. You know how they used to have those Games World stores?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's similar to that concept, and in the front window they have heaps of these model cars, and they like in the front display they normally have the Australian cars all up front. So when you said that you were getting an old Falcon, Will, I was like, oh, you could have just gone to the shops near my place and got it. I forget that you're also in Brisbane. But there's like, they always have like V8 supercars, GT Falcons, Commodores. Like they even had like the motorsport, like the final run of VF Commodores.
Yes, the VF and the Motorsport Edition. Those are the ones I keep seeing online.
Yeah,
I was tempted.
Yeah, they have ones like that in the front window of this store. So maybe next time I go there, I'll have to take a photo and show you guys because like, it's really, really cool. Mandy, you're in Melbourne. You can come have a look.
I wonder how expensive those would be then because, Will, you said they were rather not on the cheap side when you were looking for
I don't
Aussie
know if
cars.
It was a Beyonce brand, but while I was looking last night online, they had a scale model of, I want to say either it was either a VB or a VC Commodore SLE, and it was absolutely stunning. And they also did one of these diecast manufacturers actually did like a first and final. Oh, so it must have been a VB. They did a first and final edition. So they had a VB Commodore SLE and a VF Commodore, both in red, but still absolutely gorgeous, perfect detail, super expensive, but really worth it if you're a Holden fan. So I'm going to try and stay away from eBay and Gumtree now because I probably have too many diecast vehicles, but it's, I could not pass up on this. No way.
Do all the doors and the boots and the bonnet open?
Yes, they do.
Yes.
I just keep looking at it now. Now that while we're talking, I'm just like studying it. So it's very distracting.
I'm just seeing the photo. I'm keen to see.
I will. It was just really cool too because my first car, the previous owners had painted the wheels black, really shoddily, but they'd also fitted a custom exhaust. So here I am driving around in this manual BAXR6 with the like loudest exhaust. I used to drop it down to second whenever I went through tunnels. It was awesome. The only reason I sold that car was because I was moving overseas. And yeah, so I would have kept it for a lot longer had I not moved to the US.
Well, it's nice that you've got a mini version of it now for to reminisce on those times.
Definitely. And the paint quality is a lot better than on mine. It's BA Falcons for you.
Maybe they should have made them in China. Should I hope I don't offend any like old Ford Australia employees while we're listening. No, guys, it was just a joke, I swear. Anyway, car news.
Okay, yes, let's kick into car news. Jayworthy, Alfa Romeo Giulia GTA. I'm so excited that the local arm is actually looking into this.
Yeah, so I joined Alfa Romeo and a few other journalists last week for the media briefing for the updated Giulia, which launches very soon. I'll be doing the launch drive of the base model this week, so stay tuned for that review going live on the 4th of December. But on that call, one of us asked about the Giulia GTA. So for those who don't remember, Alfa Romeo revealed a wild, I don't even know how to describe it, this wild track version of the Giulia Quadrifoglio, and they have two versions of it. It's kind of similar in concept to that Jaguar XE Project 8. So it just dials everything up to 11. So there's a standard model, and then there's a GTA lowercase m, and I say lowercase m because that's how it's branded. I don't know why they've done that, but the M stands for Modificata, which in Italian just means modified, or, you know, however. Just go to
modification or something.
Yeah, something like that. So it's basically more powerful. It's lighter. It's got carbon fiber bloody everywhere. And if you get the GTA M, it removes the rear seats and adds a roll cage and gives you a 6-point racing harness and then puts this stupidly cool F1 designed aerodynamic body kit. So it's got this huge front splitter, this carbon fiber rear wing. It doesn't look real. It looks like something out of Need for Speed. On this call, we asked about this car because it was revealed in March when the Geneva Motor Show was meant to be, until it got cancelled by COVID. And the director of product strategy basically said that the local arm is still fighting to get this car here. So there's only 500 in total across both of the variants being made globally. So there's not a lot on offer. Yeah. So I think hopefully they're banking on the fact that Australia is a really big market for performance cars. I would argue that Alfa's QV products are probably more popular than the normal ones here because whenever I see a Giulia or a Stelvio, they normally are one of the sportier ones. So I can't imagine that there will be a lot of them coming here if they do manage to get it. And also the Giulia Quadrifoglio is already about $140,000. So I would say given all the bespoke appointments on this, you'd be looking in the somewhere above 150, 160 grand. You'll probably be nudging 200 by the time it hits the road. It's 100 kilos lighter than the standard one. Well, if you'd call it standard, more carbon fiber everywhere, the option of the roll cage. So it'd be really interesting to see if they end up bringing it here, but they haven't said no. So as long as there's a will, hopefully there's a way.
You would imagine they'd be snapped up very quickly because it'd be we would probably speculate what under 10 would maybe come here.
Yeah, I speculated that it would probably be in single digits if they managed to get some here, purely because it's a global allocation of 500. I would say that they would prioritize left-hand drive markets anyway, so there'd only be a handful. But, God, it looks good. Like, it just looks,
it does.
Like, you know how sometimes when you get those, you know, Need for Speed style body kits and things like that, they can just look a little bit tacky. There's just something, like, the Giulia is already a gorgeous car, don't get me wrong, but the way that they've done this, it looks like a GT3 race car for the road, and it just looks fantastic. You can read about what the GTA and GTAM get over the QV on Car Expert, because we obviously can't cover all of it here. But it's a very cool car, and if they manage to bring them here, it would just be the icing on the cake, I think, for Alfa Romeo.
Now, Will, two companies are teaming up to work on hydrogen, INEOS and Hyundai. Tell us more.
Yes. Yeah, so INEOS, if you're not aware, it's actually a very, very large corporation based in Europe. So they're a multinational petrochemical giant. But if you will have seen recently on the site, we've been covering the INEOS Grenadier, which is going to be the first car that they make. It's a body-on-frame SUV inspired by the old Land Rover Defender. So effectively, INEOS and Hyundai have signed a memorandum of understanding to, quote, explore together new opportunities in the hydrogen economy. Now, what that could mean is the Grenadier could actually pick up a hydrogen fuel cell variant. So it's actually it was revealed earlier this year, and it's supposed to be going into production soon, but it was actually going to be powered by two inline six-cylinder engines supplied by BMW, one a petrol and the other a turbo diesel. So they said right from the get-go that they wanted to diversify the powertrain options in the Grenadier lineup. So that could mean a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle. But, you know, unless you think that's all just, if that all just sounds like vaporware, pun intended, INEOS is actually, you know, a petrochemical giant. And the company actually already produces 300,000 tons of hydrogen each year through its chemical manufacturing. And through its subsidiary, Inovin, it's also Europe's largest existing operator of electrolysis, which uses renewable energy to produce hydrogen effectively. So this actually sounds like a really good matchup, right? Because INEOS has all this hydrogen just sitting around, but Hyundai actually has the technology to put it to use in vehicles, because Hyundai is, you know, an innovator when it comes to hydrogen. They were the first company to mass produce a hydrogen car. That was all the way back in 2013. They've been working on hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, you know, for a very long time. They've introduced the Nexo here, which is, it's received Australian Design Rule certification. 20 examples have been imported for use in fleets in the ACT. So a bit similar, probably a bit wider scale than what Toyota's been doing with the Mirai. So Toyota and Hyundai have been kind of the leaders when it comes to developing hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. They're not the, by any means, they're not the only companies that have been looking at hydrogen. But Hyundai has also gone ahead and developed the hydrogen powered, I'm going to guess it's Xcient, spelled X-C-I-E-N-T. So it's a hydrogen version of that heavy truck, which they're actually rolling out in Switzerland. They're rolling out 50 there this year. And the company actually aims to have 1,600 of those trucks on the road by 2025. So, you know, Hyundai's crazy about hydrogen. They've obviously invested a lot of money in it. They've been at it for quite some time. INEOS, being part of this petrochemical giant, they've got access to all of that hydrogen. So there's definitely this is a partnership that can really work. And the upside to this as well is that people could get their hands on a hydrogen fuel cell powered rugged off-roader. So that's just something that I don't think anybody has ever actually done before, which is fascinating.
Never even thought that would be a thing either.
No.
How very interesting. Wow. Okay, Jaiwo, now it feels like every single week we're talking about this issue about EV road tax. Now, Victoria is aiming to raise $30 million a year from this tax alone. It's crazy. Oh,
what's that saying, how things come in threes? Is it like the devil comes in threes or whatever? Because now we've had New South Wales, South Australia, and now Victoria. Everyone, the three, I don't know. So, yes, Victorian government, the Labor government, after, you know, getting my support from the COVID pandemic, is now, I want to kick them for doing this. They're proposing a new road tax for electric vehicles and plug-in hybrids, very similar to the stuff that we've heard out of South Australia and New South Wales. So 2.5 cents per kilometre for pure electric vehicles and 2 cents per kilometre for plug-in hybrid vehicles, announced by the Victorian Treasurer to come into effect by July 2021, provided it can get through Parliament. So for those who don't like crunching numbers, which includes myself, I'm very glad that Scott's done some calculations here. An electric vehicle owner who travels around 15,000 kilometres a year will be charged $375 on top of their annual registration fee, while a plug-in hybrid owner will pay an extra $300 a year. While the government is aiming to raise about $30 million with the tax, not all of it is necessarily going to be funneled into electric vehicle infrastructure, but the Treasurer says $45 million of the Victorian budget will be set aside to boost the take-up of hybrid, plug-in hybrid and electric vehicles. So my question is, why are they going to – it doesn't make sense they're going to tax you to then – it doesn't make any sense. I don't get it. We've now had a couple of opinion pieces written, one for the tax by Paul Marrick, and I did really like Paul Marrick until about Friday last week. And then
is he agreeing to it, I'm assuming, right? And he's got an electric car.
In all fairness, it was a more holistic view, basically saying that there needs to be a review of like the taxing structure and blah, 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 because what this is meant to do is offset the fact that as electric and plug-in hybrid vehicles get more popular, less people will be paying the fuel excise. So there's quite a few cents per litre that goes to the government every time you fill up. The thing I don't understand, though, is how Australia is now the only place in the world where it's obviously not a federal led thing, but three states now have proposed taxes on EV and plug-in hybrid cars when everywhere else in the world is trying to subsidize them, and I just can't wrap my head around why they would tax you on doing the thing that they want you to do for emissions. Like, why wouldn't you just tax people more on the petrol stuff like they do overseas? Or and how are they going to measure how many kilometers you travel a year? Like, they're going to start tracking you? I don't want the government and the popo knowing how long I spend in my car every year, and they charge me for it. Like, that's anyway. And the chairman of Electric Vehicle Council of Australia, BR Jafari, has been very, very vocal on this. I follow him on Twitter. He's not happy about this at all. He labeled the proposed tax as a shameful abdication of Victoria's intention to reduce emissions, and frankly I agree. I don't know what you guys think, but...
Oh, look, Australia's already got a reputation for being one of the largest per capita polluters in the world, and for emissions regulations that just aren't anywhere close to what they are in Europe and other parts of the world. So for this news to come out as well, kind of just makes us look a little bit worse now, doesn't it?
Yes. Makes us look so bloody stupid. Like, we've already, as you said, Will, yes, we're very high polluters. On top of that, we have awful fuel quality. So we've missed out on a lot of very refined, low consuming combustion vehicles because our fuel quality isn't there, or our legal infrastructure doesn't mandate the uptake of this stuff. So a lot of companies have now jumped to EVs. And now they're going to tax EVs. So that's going to stop people from buying them, I would think, because, you know, Australians hate paying taxes even though we pay a huge amount of tax. So what are they trying to achieve? Because now what's going to happen now? Everyone's going to be like, oh, well, no one's going to buy our stuff now because it's taxed, so we're just not going to bring electric vehicles either, and then we're left with third world country powertrains that pollute even more. I just don't understand the thinking behind it at all. And Melbourne and Victoria are meant to be quite progressive, and now we're just going backwards.
Is it their way of getting the country back after COVID? I know it's completely unrelated to cars and infrastructure, but I don't know.
I think they're just anticipating that as hybrid and electric, and because in hybrid and electric sales have grown quite a lot this year, mainly off the back of Toyota, but then with a lot of new electric vehicles coming in, you're just going to see more and more people driving those cars around, and so. I don't know. Now they're just thinking, oh, we're losing money in the fuel excise. And I actually did call this a few years ago. I don't know if either of you I'd spoken to about this, but I remember saying as a very young and fresh automotive journalist with not a lot of experience, but I made a very wise call a long time ago. I said, wait for the Australian government to realize that they are going to start losing money on the fuel tax and they'll start paying, they'll start charging you for electric cars. And here we go. My worst nightmare has become a reality. It's just madness, absolute madness. Anyway,
you probably don't feel vindicated, so.
No, I don't feel vindicated because I was hoping that I was going to be wrong. It's actually quite upsetting because I think that, you know, yes, electric cars are already expensive. Plug-in hybrid cars are already expensive, and that's down to the manufacturers pricing them too high, but also, you know, the cost of materials for, say, a battery pack. There's only so much you can do with the price of lithium. It's slowly going down, but it's still more expensive than a combustion engine. I understand that. So, like, who's going to pay? At the moment, the cheapest electric vehicle in Australia is the MG ZS EV, which is a smidgen over 42 or 43 grand drive away. Now, yes, that is an affordable electric car, but now you're going to tax on top of it. And I would say the average transaction price for Australian consumers is not above $40,000, especially when you factor in, like, average income and all that kind of stuff. Plenty of people still buy used cars. It's just gonna widen the gap, and it's gonna lengthen the uptake period because it's just gonna set everybody back if they're still having to pay more money on top of that. And as you mentioned, we've just gone through COVID. People don't have money like that anymore. Like, people have lost businesses, people have lost income and all this other nonsense, and now they want to tax you more for trying to save the planet a little bit. It's just madness.
Like, and you can change consumer behavior through taxation. So if you want people to be buying more low emissions vehicles, you maybe shouldn't be taxing them more. You should be incentivizing them a hell of a lot more, like they do in the US with the federal tax credit there, like they do in Europe. I don't understand. This is just something that can only serve to blunt the rollout of EVs in this country. Why? To what end? Well,
all they have to do is look over at what New Zealand's doing, because they have it right. They're just copying Europe. We just need to do the same thing. New Zealand gets all the UK stuff. We should just get the UK stuff. Like, anyway, thank you.
I think ACT is incentivizing EVs and hybrids, though, I think.
Yeah, it's good that someone's doing the right thing.
Yeah. This is the smallest state and territory in the entire country, mind you. But
A for effort. The thought is there.
Yes.
Anyway, let's talk about something else. It's just making me upset.
That was a really great rant, J-Lo. If you want to have your say, please shoot us an email, podcast@carexpert.com.au. Now, lastly, Will, Great Wall and Havel have hit reset. They have big plans for next year.
They do. So they've recently revealed the Great Wall, the GWM, if that's what they're calling themselves now, Ute. But all the trim levels actually start with Canon, so maybe they should have just called it Canon. But anyway, which is a cool name.
Yes.
But basically, they've introduced this much larger, much plusher, much more technologically advanced Ute to replace the, granted, cheaper Steed.
Oh, thank goodness for that.
Yes, bye-bye Steed. That Steed's being taken around behind the barn. But that's not all that Great Wall Motors is doing. So Great Wall Motors also owns the Havel brand, which is an SUV brand. You might not have heard about them, but they've actually been steadily growing since they arrived here just a few years ago. And that's been on the backs of just they initially launched with They have historically offered four models, but now they're just down to three core models. And they are getting a little bit on in years. So they've got the small H2, which is a rival for like your MG ZS, your Mitsubishi ASX, etc. They've got the mid-sized H6, which is a rival to like your Kia Sportage, Hyundai Tucson, etc. And then they've got the H9, which is actually a large ladder frame SUV. Kind of think of it as like a cut price Prado. It even looks a bit like a Prado. So the plan is for next year, and so Mike Costello put together a piece on this. Great Wall Motors actually plans to expand their dealer network from 48 sites to around 80 by the end of next year. They also want to have a new H2 and a new H6, which is really good. So those models have actually already been previewed in China. New platform. So they actually will ride on a platform architecture called Lemon, Yeah.
Lemon.
I know. But it does stand for something. It's lightweight something, well, I can't remember, but it stands for something. Obviously a little bit lost in translation. I don't think they'll use that in marketing materials here. But the good thing is that these are genuinely good looking SUVs. There are plenty of Chinese brands that don't come here, and they if you think that all Chinese cars are just kind of cheap knockoffs nowadays, that's not the case. Chinese car companies, well, it is the case for some of the smaller brands that don't come here, but Chinese companies have gotten very good at sourcing talent, whether that be components like engines and transmissions from established companies, whether that be actual like executives and engineers from other companies. And Havel, Great Wall Motors is no exception there. So they'll have a new H6 and a new H2 coming here next year. I imagine from what we've heard in the past, the H9 will eventually be redesigned as well and actually be based on the same platform as the new Great Wall. I'm going to call it Canon. I'm not going to call it the new Great Wall Canon. So basically the Great Wall Canon has launched. It starts from 33,990 drive away. It's actually larger than a Hilux, a little bit less powerful and with less towing capacity than, say, a 2.8 litre Hilux, but very, very sharp pricing for a dual cab ute. And styling that kind of gives me like a little shrunken Toyota Tundra vibe. So it looks appropriately tough. And the upcoming Havel H2 and H6 look thoroughly contemporary inside and out. It's actually really funny. If you go to Havel's Chinese website, their range is – this Chinese companies are absolutely insane like this. They just offer 1,000 different variants, and every single time they introduce a new model, they typically just keep the old one in production for a while. So right now there are 3 generations of Havel H6 on sale. And then there are different variations of those. They all their SUVs start with the letter H, but then they introduced a couple that start with the letter F and one that starts with the letter M. And then they started a new sub-brand called Way, which is like their kind of upscale brand. Genuinely nice-looking SUVs, I should say. So
not confusing at all.
No, not confusing. par for the course for a Chinese brand, though. But yeah, it's very good to see that they're just focusing on a very like kind of tailored lineup here, just 3 models. And yeah, it looks like next year is going to be very exciting for both the Great Wall brand and also the Havel brand.
I wonder how long it will take for these two brands to be right up there and see the success that Kia and Hyundai are having now. Do you reckon that those two brands probably took maybe 10 years to get where they are now?
It's so funny though, because you know, when the Japanese first started making cars, people said, "Oh, made in Japan, that just means it's cheap crap." And they got, you know, Toyota initially got pretty much laughed out of the US with the initial Toyo Pet Crown. And then the Koreans started making cars and exporting them. And everyone was like, "Oh, the Koreans, what cheap crap." And they were making things like the Pony and the XL and, you know, really nothing to write home about. But you know what? They started sourcing the talent. They started building genuinely good cars. And, you know, you're right. I think Hyundai, what launched here in the mid to late 80s, by the mid 90s, the XL very briefly was Australia's best-selling car, outselling Commodore and Falcon. And then Hyundai's just, you know, grown from there. So I'm very curious to see how these Chinese brands, specifically MG and Great Wall and Havel, go. Now, Great Wall has had a little bit of a rocky past. They were the first Chinese brand to start selling vehicles here, or start selling utes, and that was over 10 years ago now. They did switch distributors. They briefly paused their operations here. There were a lot of recalls. They did damage their reputation there, but then they relaunched, and look, the steed, nothing really to write home about, but this ute looks to be their most serious effort yet. Inside and out, it looks good. It's got the safety technology that's expected of the class. The capability in terms of towing and power, not quite there yet. However, we have heard, you know, rumors that there will be more powerful turbo diesel engines coming. So it's only going to be up from here. But yeah, very, very, very curious to see. Havel is one of those brands that I'm like, secretly really fascinated by it. Well, not even secretly, because I'm saying it on a friggin' podcast. So. Unashamedly fascinated by it because no one seems to know who they are and nobody seems to be paying attention to them. And yet a lot of people are actually buying their vehicles and those sales numbers just keep steadily growing. So, you know, before you know it, who knows where they'll be.
Yeah, watch this space. Head to carexpert.com.au to get your daily fix of car news. Hello to the man who has driven the 2021 Toyota GR Yaris and to the man we all envy, Paul Marrick. Hello.
Are they related, the driving and the envy?
Perhaps. look, we've spoken about this small hot hatch in detail already on the podcast, so I'm just going to come out and straight out ask you, how was it and did it live up to your expectations?
Okay, so first up, where did we get the car from? Because you'll be hearing about this before the national launch. Well, we realised that deliveries had started and one of our good friends who runs Tuner's Edge, which is a tuning shop in Melbourne, he got his car delivered like 2 or 3 weeks ago and we thought, why don't we just drive his car, given it's the exact same as the press cars we'll finally get access to? So he was grateful enough to let us do that, or we were grateful rather. And we went out for a drive in his car. And look, to be honest, I didn't think this was going to be much more than just a hotted up Yaris. This thing is like next level. It is insane. So it is a three-cylinder turbocharged petrol engine. In fact, it's the world's most powerful three-cylinder engine in a production car. 200 kilowatts of power, 370 newton meters of torque. And all of that makes a whole lot more sense when you realize it weighs just over 1,200 kilograms. And the thing that really surprised me the most about this, and the reason we should all be so impressed with this car, is the only reason it exists is they needed to homologate a car for rally. And to do that, they had to create a car that would be similar in some ways to the rally vehicle, and they'd be able to sell 25,000 of them. That was a requirement. And what they did is they produced a car that is the front end of a Yaris, the rear end of a Corolla at a CHR, and then a car that has a carbon fiber roof, sits 95 millimeters lower than a standard Yaris. It is just like this, just this concoction of things, and they've ended up with what I think is one of the most potent hot hatches on the market.
How does it sound?
That's the bit that isn't that great.
Yeah,
inside it sounds awesome and it's like, oh, wow, everyone must be smiling on the outside. And then you hear it on the outside and you're like, oh, has he switched it on yet? Because it's not making any sound. Yeah, it's really quiet on the outside, but the guys at Tuner's Edge have actually already developed an exhaust for it. So with the exhaust, it sounds next level. I get the feeling with this, it's going to be like the 86 where they give it to you stock and with like nothing, and then you do all the work to it.
Does it come with standard dual pipes or what's at the back?
Yeah, it's got dual pipes, but okay. I don't know. Inherently, a three-cylinder engine has this quite unique raspy sort of burble to it, and it does have that up the front. You hear a lot of induction noise as well, but then out the back, it's just, I don't know. It could just be one of these Euro regulation type things where they have to appease the fun police and make it quiet. But yeah, look, it's interesting what they've done to it. Now, in terms of performance figures, Toyota claims 0 to 105.2. Now, where we drove the car, which was at Sandown Raceway, we had the back straight reserved for us, and unfortunately, it's not flat. So the best we could get was 5.4, but the owner who told me about how he launches it, and when I heard that, I'm like, I'm not going to do that to your car. He launches it from just under 5,500 RPM. It is, yeah, it is mental. And it's got an all-wheel drive system. It can vary torque split up to 100% front or 100% rear. So it's a fairly serious setup. But doing all of that, he managed to get a 0 to 100 time of under 5 seconds and a quarter mile time of the mid to low 13-second mark. So it's a properly quick little car.
So, Paul, we've talked about how it sounds. We've talked about the figures and, you know, the figures we kind of sort of knew already. So now you've driven it, what do you think?
Okay, so I drove it at the track, but we didn't go too hard with it because, again, it wasn't our car. But I was impressed with the amount of traction it has. The all-wheel drive system is smart enough to take care of all the sort of bits and pieces you need to take care of when you're driving a car like that on a track. There is a more hardcore version coming, which has front and rear locking differentials. It's got a spray for the intercooler. It's got all these extra bits that will really convert this into a proper track car. But I think for 99% of people, the non-track version is going to suit perfectly fine. And it's idiot-proof. Like, you can drive it all yourself, or you've got like an intelligent manual shifting mode where it will rev match. You can switch off everything to do like four-wheel drive burnouts and sort of donuts and stuff. So, like, I don't know, they just thought of everything here, and it is incredibly smile-inducing. Now, the only problem I've got, though, is at $39,000 drive away, I think it is the steal of the century. But when you get to that $50,000 mark plus on-road costs, which is what it'll cost now that they've sold that initial special pricing allocation, I just wonder whether it's going to be a little too expensive.
Did you find anything in that car that Toyota perhaps could have done better with?
That's a good question. Look, the interior is just a Yaris, but they've gone to the effort of putting cool-looking seats in. It's got a nice steering wheel, all that sort of stuff. But I don't know. It is really difficult to fault. I think outside of just noise and probably the brake pedal feel, I find the same with my Supra. For some reason, it just doesn't have any brake pedal feel. They bite really hard, but you just don't get that feedback through the pedal. But outside of that, it is incredibly hard to fault it.
Cool. I'd be keen to know what your thoughts are on the styling of it.
Okay. In the pictures, I thought, that looks funny. But in person, It is incredible. Like, it has the biggest grille I've ever seen. And then as you look down the side of the car, it just gets wider as you get to the rear. And then at the rear, it's like a Hilux. Like, it is huge. Yeah, the styling is incredible. It turns so many heads. And people just think when they first glance that it's just a Yaris. And then when they realize what it is, like, holy crap, that thing is like a machine. So, yeah, the styling is really cool. It is really nice and aggressive. And I'll be keen to see. It appears to me, based on sort of looking at the car and how much headroom they have, that they'll be releasing tuning packs and other sort of GR components to make them faster. Arthur from Tuner's Edge said that currently the car is running at roughly 80% capacity. So, and that was with the, what did he say it was? I think it was the electronic throttle control. So he said that once you tune that and make that 100%, you instantly get 20% more of everything. And that's before you even change any hardware or do any sort of tuning beyond the standard equipment. So I think Toyota may have a little bit up its sleeve in terms of extra performance down the track.
Paulie, we've covered quite a bit about how the Yaris GR is going to get a second variant in Australia next year in the form of the Rally Edition.
Yep.
Overseas, it's sold as like the performance pack or whatever they call it. So you get some extra diffs, you get lighter wheels, track tires, all that kind of stuff. Given that you've now experienced the standard car and it's pretty good from what you've told us, do you think it's worth waiting and spending the extra money? Not that we know how much it costs, but the extra on what the Rally Edition will likely cost next year?
Well, look, I did a little bit of sleuthing, and in the UK, I think it was £3,500 extra. So if you translate that to Australia, it's going to cost at least $5,000 extra. So you're looking at probably 60 grand on the road. I just don't know that it's – look, if you're a track driver and you're going to really go to town on this at the racetrack, yeah, fair enough. All of that extra stuff will be great. But if you're just driving it on the road and just wanting something that'll put a smile on your face and just goes hard – I don't know that it's worth spending the money on. And more importantly, I'm curious to see what happens now. So they've sold the initial 1,250. The first 1,000 were at 39,000 drive away. The next 250 were at 45,000 drive away. I'll be curious to see what happens in a year's time when supply comes back to us, because why would you go and pay 50 plus on roads now when someone else has just paid 15 grand less? And how will that work for resale value? Yeah, it'll be a curious space in about a year's time, and that could limit the uptake of the Rally model, because unless they do drive away pricing on that as well, that's going to be a massive, massive step up from what people have already paid for this one. Yeah, I was just shocked at how much you can abuse this car, because, okay, I keep saying this, but it wasn't our car, but we still drove it a little bit hard. But the owner has been absolutely going to town on this thing, and it feels brand new. So I'm just really curious to see, once they've spent a bit of time tuning it and putting in a little bit of extra hardware, exactly how much power they can extract from this. I would not be surprised if they get 300 kilowatts out of it. It would be too far off, I reckon.
It's going to be an awesome pocket rocket if they can get to those sort of numbers. Man, you can search Toyota GR Yaris up at carexpert.com.au to take a look at the pictures and read more. Paul Marek, thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Australia loves its mid-size SUVs, accounting for around 20% of Australia's market share this year. But there's one brand that often gets overlooked in this segment, Ford. Well, it might get more notice now with its 2021 Escape. Joe, why do you think the previous model never really was a big winner for Ford?
The previous one, I think, struggled for a few reasons. I think that people really liked the design of other models like the CX-5. So CX-5 and Tucson have been top sellers for ages, and then the current Toyota RAV4 has really picked up, I would say, mainly because of the hybrid option and the fact that it's very tech-laden compared to the old one. With the old Escape as well, before they changed it to Escape, they used to call it the Cougar because our cars are sourced from Europe, and over there that's what our car is called. And there was a few global issues with quality and fire hazards and all this nonsense. So I think it may have turned people off the brand because, like, if you go around Melbourne, I don't know about the other states, but you see a lot of previous generation Cougars around. Like, there's still a decent amount of them. And there's actually quite a few of the most recent Escape in certain pockets of Melbourne. So I was driving the latest one last week, and I know that they always say when you start driving something different or driving something new, you notice all the other ones on the road. But I didn't see another new Escape on the road. I just saw the billboards. But I saw lots of old Escapes out on the road. So it was very odd. And I've noticed that because I live in eastern Melbourne, and I've noticed that there's quite a lot of Focuses and Escapes around here. So it might just be I'm in a pocket because there used to be a dealer around here. It's no longer there. But so I think that it's a combination of things, be it the design. The old one was a little bit small, and then also some of the long-term reliability or the perception of long-term reliability that may not have sat well with people. But having driven this new one, I think that Ford could really be onto something here.
So what's changed with the new one?
Well, it's a complete generational overhaul. So the new Escape is now underpinned by Ford's C2 architecture, which also is under the current Focus. So it's a longer and wider car. It's a lighter platform, so it saves weight, which should make it more fuel efficient and it should be better dynamically. But it's also roomier. So one of the issues with the previous Escape is that as all of its rivals got bigger, particularly in Australia and the US, the Escape was still quite a compact car, so the back seats weren't huge and the boot wasn't that large either, competitively within its rival set. So this model really addresses all of that, and now they're really going hard on offering a high level of specification across the range. And it's also what people might not realize is that it's a European designed and engineered product, and the Australian model Escape, even though it shares its name with the US model, we actually get our cars from Spain. So it comes out of their Valencia factory, which also produces the Mondeo, which has sadly left us. But so it's a European designed and engineered product. Over there, it's very, very popular. Focus and Cougar do very well in Europe. And they're basically like a very close alternative to Volkswagen. So, but they kind of have a more sporting edge to them. So, you know, we tend to see Volkswagen products as more of a comfort focused premium sort of thing. So think of Volkswagen as like a mainstream Mercedes or Audi product, whereas the Ford stuff tends to be more of like a BMW. They're normally a little bit sharper, a bit more focused on driver engagement, and they might be that now they're a little bit more refined in terms of their design, but they're always a little bit more sporty looking. So what it's trying to do with this new one, I think, is get people back into the Ford showroom, not just to buy a Ranger, but to also buy an Escape. Because as you mentioned earlier, the midsize SUV segment is overwhelmingly the favorite in our market. And at the moment, Ford is accounting for about 1% of all midsize SUV sales, when by comparison, a Toyota RAV4 accounts for about 30%. So you can see that there's not necessarily a huge gap in product quality or competence in terms of how each car drives, but clearly people are favoring certain vehicles in the segment for a reason. And I think that this new car is their best bet yet at becoming a proper competitor in terms of sales in that class.
Mm. Rather impressive. You reviewed the entry-level Escape. It doesn't look entry-level, and all the features you get with it are usually on a higher spec'd model.
Yeah, so what they've done here, and to preface this, I used to work at Ford before I came to Car Expert, so I did a lot of work on Escape and Puma in the earlier months of this year in the lead-up to the launch. So I've been across, you know, what is offered overseas, what's offered here, and blah, 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 blah. So what they've done is they've gotten rid of the base models, well, the proper base models, and this, even though it's a, quote, entry-level model, it's more of a mid to high spec in terms of, you know, standard features and all that kind of stuff. So it's more in line with, say, your RAV4 GXL or Mazda CX-5 Max Sport or Touring rather than the base grades that are normally favored by fleets. So it's got all of the active safety tech as standard. You've got autonomous emergency braking with pedestrian and cyclist detection. You've got adaptive cruise control with stop and go, lane keep assist, lane centering. You've got LED headlights, a big touchscreen with satellite navigation, Apple CarPlay and Android Auto. You've got wireless phone chargers, dual zone climate control. The list goes on. So it's very, very well decked out. And for Ford fans, and I know that there's a few Ford fans that read our site and probably listen to this podcast, the base grade of Escape in Australia is actually in line with what they call the titanium overseas. So in Europe, you have... Oh. The Escape Z-Tech, so that's a throwback because we used to have Focus Z-Techs in Australia a long time ago. And then it goes titanium, and titanium and the ST line sort of sit alongside each other, where titanium is sort of like the comfort or luxury Focus offering, and then you've got the ST line as the more sporty one. And then in the UK, you can then upgrade your ST line to be ST Line X, which has a few more luxury features, and then there's the Vignale, which is the first time that we've had the Vignale badge in Australia, and it's kind of takes the place of the old titanium. So it's fully kitted out. It's got more luxury appointments. It's probably the closest thing that you can get to Ford trying to challenge the luxury brands in terms of overall look and feel. We'll have one later in December, but basically what those top models build on is sort of you've got this really solid base offering that has all the bases covered. And then you can sort of add a more sporting or more luxurious vibe by spending a little bit more money and getting some of the extra comfort and luxury features that the base one may not have. But I think what really sets the Escape apart from its competitive set, particularly at the base level, is that it comes with a 2-litre turbocharged engine as opposed to a similarly sized naturally aspirated engine, and it has class-leading outputs. It's by far the most powerful car in its class, and especially at this price point, there's nothing else that offers equivalent specs on paper, but also just real world performance. So it's got 184 kilowatts and 387 newton meters, which is huge. And it's got an 8-speed automatic as standard. So there's no need to spend extra for, you know, over a base manual like you might find with some competitors. So what this car really, in my mind, does is that it offers a more affordable option in the segment that really has the grunt for somebody who might be doing a lot of country highway touring. So I know that a lot of these cars nowadays at the cheaper end sort of are great for people who just sort of like do urban runabouts, pick up the kids from school and whatever. But if you really, yeah, a lot of these base level rivals in that midsize SUV class, they're base engines are either like 2 liters or 2.5 liters. They're naturally aspirated and they're fine for getting up to 60 or 80. But then when you're at 100 or 110 and you have to do an overtake or something on a country freeway, it can actually be quite scary, especially for people who aren't used to it. The Escape is just, there's none of those issues. It is so strong in performance. And it's still very linear in its delivery. So it doesn't make its peak torque until about 3000 RPM, which is quite high for a turbocharged engine these days. Normally, like with a Volkswagen engine, for example, you'll get peak torque at about 1500 RPM. So it's almost on tap as soon as you hit the pedal. Whereas this one's very linear. So it behaves sort of like a very high power, naturally aspirated engine. And it's basic. And I know that there's been a bit of debate in the comments of the review that went live today about whether having a basic looking interior is really a con or not. But I know that I had a few people sit in it and was like, oh, it looks a bit basic. It's just it's a really well-rounded product. And I think that especially Ford's European products, the Focus, the Escape, and the Fiesta, they deserve a little bit more love from Aussie buyers, because I know everyone loves a Ranger, but their European product really stacks up.
Look, I think this is, it's really strange that the Escape hasn't traditionally done better here, because if you look last year in Europe, it was in the top 20 best-selling cars. If you look in the US, it was in the top 20 best-selling cars. It was actually the fifth best-selling car in its segment. So it's a little bit baffling. This model seems to stack up really well. And I think what really got my attention when I first saw the press release drop for this is 184 kilowatts in the base model. Really? Like that's good. I mean, a lot of rivals don't even offer up-level engines that offer that amount of power. You've got like the Mazda CX-5 and, you know, that's, I'm struggling to think of Volkswagen Tiguan maybe, but there's really not that many options out there if you want a punchy mid-sized SUV. So, you know, kudos to Ford for doing that. It's very interesting to see them offer this base model that's kind of not really a base model, that is really more mid-spec when you stack it up against competitors. I noticed that Ford, Jay, well, you might correct me on this, but I know that Ford introduced the current generation of Focus with a base model Ambiente, but then that disappeared really quickly from memory. So it seems like Ford's positioning their passenger car offerings as perhaps a little bit more premium than they were before, and not offering those really bare bones basic models. But I'll be very curious to see how this does, and I'm very curious to get behind the wheel as well, not just because that's a good amount of power for a mid-sized SUV, but because it, from what you've said, it sounds like it's quite a satisfying drive. And there's a lot of SUVs in the segment that are very competent, very sensible, very good for A to B driving, but don't really stir the soul. And I love a kind of underdog in this segment. I actually have two different Holden Equinoxes in my family, and they're, you know, not that exciting to look at, and certainly not the interior. I would argue it's a worse interior than the Escape. But get behind the wheel of one of those, and they're actually really good drive. And they also offered an up-spec. They also offered a turbocharged 2-liter 4-cylinder, which I've yet to drive. It's not like there'll be any on press fleet, unfortunately. But very, very intrigued to see how this Escape does.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you mentioned the Equinox, Will, because that's actually what I was going to get at, is that, you know, Mandy, I remember we had an Equinox 2-litre long-termer at our previous place of work. And if you liked how that drove, it's the Escape kind of takes on that. It's not super sporty in how it through steering feel and stuff, but it's a very well-balanced chassis. It's very, very effortlessly powerful, and it just has a really nice fluid feel to how it drives without, you know, being, it's just a nice thing to drive. It's not as sharp as a Focus, for example. So that's one thing I really love about the Focus, is that its steering is super sharp and super quick. So you almost feel like you're driving a go-kart. Whereas the Escape traditionally has been a little bit more, it's still meant to be fun, but it's not as sharp. And I think it's more to cater for that typical mid-size SUV buyer that wants something that's just comfortable and effortless to drive every day. Yeah, I just think that this is a much more well-rounded offering. It's much more spacious than the old one. It stacks up on paper and then some. So I also have a dealer friend, actually, who said that he's already sold three Vignalis at his dealership. Ooh. And the car's only been out for like a month or two. Mm-hmm. So they seem to be doing okay, and he sold a few ST lines as well. So I'm just really hoping that we see more of these on the roads, because if you go out in Melbourne anyway, I don't know about Brisbane, Will, but there's quite a lot of those digital billboards with the Escape advertisement on it. So I'm hoping that we see a little bit more marketing backing from Ford, because it's a very important product for them, and hopefully we just start to see more on the road, because I like an underdog too, and I've always seen Ford's European cars as underdogs, because they're a little bit more, they've normally been a little bit more expensive, and I think people aren't necessarily willing to pay Volkswagen money for a Ford here, because it's never been considered in the same regard as opposed to how they are in Europe, where they are very much considered in the same regard. So I think this could be really the shot in the arm, as well as the Puma, the shot in the arm that Ford really needs, that, you know, that for stuff that's not Ranger or Mustang.
Did you mention price before? Is it well priced?
So this model starts at $35,990 plus on road costs, but at the moment they're doing national driveway pricing for the base model and the mid-spec ST line. So this car is just under $37,000 driveway, which is pretty competitive. It's pretty much in line with most mid-spec offerings. So yes, it's not the, you know, the $30,000 or $33,000 price leader that someone might expect from an entry-level mainstream brand. But in terms of features, engine specs and everything, I think it's fantastic value for money.
Mm, there you go. The written review and the video that Paul Marek has done is now up at carexpert.com.au. Go and check it out. That brings an end to this week's podcast. What sort of cars are in the garage next week, Jaywork?
We've got quite a lot of things coming in next week, and we've actually started going back to press events. How weird is that? After how long of not going anywhere, we can actually go places. So next week in Melbourne, we've got an Audi Q2. We've got the Toyota Yaris ZR Hybrid, another Ford Puma. So we've got a base model. This week we've got a top of the line one, and next week we're swapping into a base model. We've also got a Skoda Karoq 140 TSI Sportline. That's been very requested in the comments and on YouTube and on the site. So we've got that coming soon. In Sydney, we've got the new Hyundai i30 sedan, and we'll also be covering the launch of the Volkswagen Touareg V8 TDI, which is very exciting. And Brisbane, you've got an Audi SQ5 and a Genesis G80. And then in terms of events, we've got a Mercedes GLS and GLB press launch. I figure that that's sort of just making up the lack of press launch that those models had during lockdown. We've got the updated Audi S4, S5, and also the SQ5 TDI. I will preface that with they're launching an SQ5 TDI in December, even though there's an updated model coming next year. We're just getting the last of the current model. It's very confusing. And then I will also be going to do the BMW 4 Series press launch, and I will also have the updated Alfa Romeo Giulia over the weekend. The weekend before this goes live. So there's a few press launches coming up.
Great.
There's a lot going on.
That is such good news that finally things are starting to get back to normal.
Yes. Oh, actually, we also have an Lexus LC500 convertible in Melbourne next week. I'm very excited to see that. I'm hoping it's a green one with brown interior, because I will be making sure I get an Insta pic with that.
Is it that forest green? Is that what the actual name of it is called?
Stunning. It's called, in Australia, they call it khaki metal. Yeah. Okay. In other places, they call it nori green, like seaweed. So it's like it's kind of got this, like, it's sort of like a forest green, but it's kind of got, I don't even know how to describe it. It's got like this metal,
It's sort of got like when you get it in the right light, it's even got a bit of yellow tinge to it as well.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
It's a really interesting color. Yeah, it has this really light shine through it. So yeah, when you hit it with the right light in the right place, it shows off the curves of whatever car it's on. I personally think it looks much better on the LC than it does on, say, a UX. But but it's a beautiful color, and it's great to see colors like that making a comeback. You know, we're seeing a lot of bright blues, reds, greens. It's just we love color in the car world, because the gray rainbow that has been dominating for so long is just very tired.
I couldn't agree more. James Wong and William Stopford, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.